Hello and welcome to the program. Today we hear concerns coming from experts who say that bumblebees are literally starving to death. It's good news for nightjars. One of the world's most enigmatic bird species has been rediscovered here in Ireland. And never mind about the woman who swallowed a fly, I swallowed an insect.
I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die. I know an old lady who swallowed a spider to twiggle, to jiggle, to twiggle inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
Believe it or not, that's our very own Aine Ní Lana singing "I Know an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly." And Aine Ní Lana is with us here in studio, as is Richard Collins. Now, Aine, the reason we're playing that is because the other day I swallowed an insect. I couldn't believe it. This time of year, swallowing an insect. And I coughed and I splurted and everything else, and I nearly choked. Am I going to die?
I don't know why you swallowed the fly, Derek.
I don't know if it was a fly even.
But you might die, because a lot of insects are eaten by people as they eat their food, because a lot of plant food will have bits of insects in them, heads, wings, legs. In fact, there are regulations as to how much is allowed to be in certain types of food.
And like in your cereal and the like.
Like in your cereal, like in your spinach, like in any kind of processed food, grain, bread, things like this. So people, I would say, over the course of a year might eat up to a kilogram of bits of insects.
Not to mention the old kind of myth that we swallow tons of them at night when we're in bed asleep, spiders crawling into our mouth and in our nostrils and into our ears and all that kind of stuff. Do you believe any of that?
I mean, it's not a matter of belief. Either we do or we don't. So, I mean, do you keep your bedroom filthy? What are you doing at night, licking the walls? You know, this sort of thing. I don't believe that we swallow loads of spiders at night, quite frankly. No, I don't. But the thing about the insects and that eating them gives a lie, actually, to people who are vegan and don't want to be eating any kind of animal matter. Well, they are eating all of this carry-on when they're eating their food.
In defence of the vegans, Anna, the insects are actually dead and as doughnuts. I remember reading...
But nobody eats live anything.
Well, that's true, but their
steaks are dead when we eat them.
I know, but you don't kill for it, shall we say. You don't go killing the insects in order to eat them, whereas you kill the bullock in order to eat the steak. But I read somewhere that each of us consumes something like a kilo of insect parts every year. It reminds me of the tubes in London, all that dust. About half of that dust, I'm told, is dried particles of human skin.
Oh, lovely. Never mind, mind the gap, mind the dust.
Well, Derek, if you want to avoid eating a fly, keep your gob shut.
Thank you, Aine.
Mind the gap.
Now, bees are our most effective pollinators. They're vital to our survival on the planet. And there are few sounds as distinctive or as welcome as the sunny buzz of the bumblebee. But is that sound about to vanish imminently from our countryside and gardens? That is the concern coming from experts who say that the bumblebee is starving to death. About a third of Ireland's bumblebee species are critically endangered, and their loss would trigger a wider emergency for food production and indeed for wildlife. In Ireland, we have 101 bee species, to the best of our knowledge. Most face the same plight as the bumblebee. Quite simply, if our bees disappear, many of our flowering plants, fruits and birds will disappear with them. Paul O'Brien is president of the Federation of Irish Beekeepers, and he joins us now from our studio in Galway. Hello, Paul. It's very nice to talk to you. Let's begin by distinguishing the bumblebee from the honeybee, because you're very interested in honeybees, as we know from our time on the programme with the late Philip McCabe.
Well, as a beekeeper, we take a keen interest in all of our bees, our solitary bees, our bumblebees, and of course our honeybees. But there's a bigger problem too with all insects. So we actually need to care for all the insect environment.
Well, let's talk about the bumblebee first. What's going on there?
Well, the bumblebee, its habitat has been attacked, for want of a better word, and the climate isn't helping it either. We have beekeepers who keep records for the last 20 years of doing bumblebee counts. And the biggest decline we had this year was in Kilkenny. We had 42% decline of the bumblebee. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest problems we have at the moment is the lack of forage and habitat for bees. We've gone as a society into these big monocultures of crops within the pasture lands, and we've left no escape routes or no edges of the fields for our insects and our bumblebees to get, A, food, and two, places to hide and nest.
So then, are you compounding the issue then as a beekeeper by turning up with beehives? I mean, honeybees are not in danger. And what you're actually doing then, bringing new hives into an area, is sending out more hungry mouths to be fed in an area that can't even keep the bumblebees going. I mean, can you actually say the two things can happen? Is it like saying we'll have loads of chickens so that we'll save the bird population?
Well, not necessarily. In Ireland, we've 3,500 beekeepers in my organisation, the Federation of Irish Beekeepers, and most of them are hobbyists, so they'd have one to five hives, which is not a great pressure on the environment. Where I come from, in the west of Ireland, there was no beekeepers in my area, and we've reintroduced bees, and they're native Irish bees we have. So by doing that, we are helping the flowers pollinate them, and there'll be more flowers in the following season, which means there's more diversity for the wildlife as well.
Paul, that idea that somehow the domestic bee is taking over and is eliminating the food that Ian has suggested there, it's an interesting one, but I'm throwing my mind back to my childhood. Back then in Limerick, lots of people kept bees. We kept bees in the back garden and out the country as well. It was very common for people to keep bees. So the question arises, are there more bee colonies, honeybee colonies now than there were back then? Has there been a massive takeover?
Oh, I would think the opposite has happened. If you went back into the mid-40s and 50s and 60s, most beekeepers kept 20 hives or even more. And now most beekeepers are hobbyists, so they keep five to, as I say, one, five and 10. And what we've noticed over the last few years is that the core membership of the Federation of Irish Beekeepers is around 1,500 to 2,000 members. And with a transient every year of about 1,000 new beginners joining up and coming in every year. And even if they don't keep bees, they come to our courses and they spend 6 weeks or six lectures, whichever, six one-hour lectures. And they learn all about the environment and the bees. And they go off and they tell all their friends and neighbours to look out at the window of the environment by learning what they've learned from beekeeping. So I wouldn't think that the number of beehives has increased dramatically. It was very low 8-9 years ago, and we are building it up year on year. Some of these bees are being kept in the suburbs of cities where there was none. And I can see it in areas where there are beekeepers taking up the sport or the hobby over the last 5-6 years, and they're telling their neighbours and their friends are growing trees and plants that are beneficial to all the insects. And they're bringing an awareness to the hedgerows and everything. So the benefit of the beekeepers in Ireland outweighs any risk that may be perceived there.
I'm glad you mentioned suburban areas, because I have a lot to do around the country with tidy towns committees. And one of the things that tidy towns people do, I mean, they do lots of very, very good things improving the environment in urban areas. But they quite often plant things that are not at all suitable for bees. I mean, if you think, for example, that a bumblebee comes out of hibernation, the queen, because everything else has died, and she has to eat enough, she has to find enough food. She makes a nest, a little nest to begin with, and she gets pollen to make the pollen food, and she lays the eggs, and she has to get some nectar to feed herself. She has to visit 8,000 flowers to get that done before she lays any eggs to have any babies at all. Now, if you come out in the beginning of the year, at this time of the year, and all you can find are blinking daffodils, what good is that? There's no nectar in the daffodils, there's no pollen in the daffodils, and we should be encouraging people who grow plants not to be growing ones that are useless for bees. You look at the hanging baskets in towns, and they're full of petunias and begonias and primulas and red flowers. Bees can't see red. Why are they not planting things like bidens and bacopas?
How do you know bees can't see red, Aina?
Because it's not that I know this, Aina ni Launa. This has actually been done by scientific experts who look at the bees' eyes. The bees' range of vision goes from ultraviolet down as far as the beginning of the orange spectrum and stops there. Ours starts at the violet and goes all the way down to red. We can see red. Bees, when bees look at red, it looks black to them. But they can see in the ultraviolet spectrum, mm-hmm. so that when they look at the flowers, if you see swanky pictures on the web and things taken through ultraviolet lenses, and the middle of flowers are lit up like Dublin Airport, like runways. But in the wild, the only red flower really is the poppy, and the inside of that has all these ultraviolet lines going into it, and it's an open flower. But a big red rose, like everybody's running around with for Valentine's Day, all closed up like a big cabbage, that's useless for bees. So we should encourage people who are bringing then, so the tidy towns people might decide, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a few honey beehives as well, in an area where there isn't enough food for the bumblebees at all because they've been planting the wrong things. So, like, it's not just as easy as Paul says, you know, there's... they will help. They'll only help if the countryside is fit to sustain them. I mean, there's a big campaign to encourage people to leave their dandelions when they come up in spring rather than considering them as weeds, because dandelions are full of nectar and they're full of pollen.
You'd prefer dandelions to daffodils, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, I would. They're lovely. I remember when my son, who is now 35, and killed me for mentioning this, when he was two, he brought me in a lovely bunch of dandelions to put in the vase because he thought they were lovely and yellow. And his big sister, who was five, said, they're only weeds. How could you bring them into Mammy? So, of course, they had to be put in the swankiest vase on the table because he had the right idea. Lovely yellow flowers, and he wasn't even a bee. So you can imagine how important it is to have these things. It's all brainwashing. Why should we hate dandelions and love daffodils? And if you were a bee, you certainly wouldn't.
Paul?
No, Ian is correct on the planting. The planting has not very beneficial to the bees and the bumblebees. At the moment, we do give lectures to the tidy towns and we do tell them, as Ian has said, to leave the dandelions and leave the flowers that are suitable for bees. And at this time of year, furze bushes are out, and furze bushes are the first pollen that we see coming into the hives. And again, we've tidied up our gardens too much. You know, let's let them go a little bit wild and let's set aside a quarter of your lawn to bees and to insects as well.
I'm reminded of a phrase of Tommy Hayden's, where he said, specialists go to the wall while the generalists inherit the earth. Now, my impression of the bee world is that the honeybee is the great generalist. He can turn his attention to anything. You'll get ivy, you'll get heather he'll exploit this, he'll exploit all kinds of plants and things. He can turn his hand
to... is the female.
I'm well aware of that, Ina. She is the female. Now, give me a chance, will you? Now, the other thing, if you take the bumblebees, it seems to me that they are specialists. They have contracted with individual flowers. There's 20 of them out there, and the flowers have negotiated, I'm going to concentrate on you because I want you to go to my kind of flower so that my pollen gets to the right flower and doesn't get wasted on flowers that are no use to me, you see. So you get this kind of specialisation in bumblebees. I presume that that is the model. So when the pressure comes on then, the specialists are more critical. They need a particular small range of plants, whereas something like the honeybees can change their tune and go off with something else. Is this model reasonable, Paul? Is there any basis for that?
No, what you say is 100% correct. But I'll go back to Ian and say, look, as beekeepers, we are the keepers in the sense of the bees, and we look at the environment around us, and we are promoting the environment. And we always tell our beekeepers not to flood an area. We suggest that no more than three hives for a 5-acre location. That way we're not putting pressure on the environment, as Ian is trying to allay. But we're also the spokespersons up and down the country telling children in schools and people we meet at market stalls that we have to protect our environment. And our biggest campaign for the last 3 years has been to protect the hedgerows. Mm. Because for some unknown reason, we've got this in our head in Ireland lately, to remove the hedgerows. Now, England and all over Europe, they're building insect highways up and down the country to put back in these hedgerows. And one thing we should all do as a society is to leave insect nature reserves. These may be 10 acres or smaller, and leave these highways leading up and down the country. We have to share the whole planet with all the insects and all the humans, but we have to plan this. It's not whether the honeybee is the king or the queen, for to be correct about it, but not that one species is more popular than another. We have to share the planet and we have to make a space for everybody.
Well, no, but back to Richard's point, if you're going to plan ahead and make sure that we share the planet for all the species that inhabit the planet, then you can take out the plants that the bumblebee needs if it is a specialist, and you can make sure that more of those species are planted. Am I not correct in saying that?
Oh, you're spot on correct in saying that. We need to plant those as well. But if we have no hedgerows and we have 50 acres of just green pasture grass, where are you going to grow this? We have to plant it. And the idea all over Europe is a 2-metre wide corridor at no more than 5 kilometres apart leading to these sanctuaries all over the country. And we have it. We already have it in the country. We don't have to do it. It's called hedgerows. Stop removing them. That's our campaign for the last 2 years, is to leave them. You know, if we don't have insects and bees and bumblebees, we don't have birds, the whole lot would collapse.
The point that Richard's making is that the bumblebees go to specific flowers, and if those specific flowers aren't there, the bumblebees won't survive. Is that actually true? I mean, can bumblebees not be able to go to the ordinary flowers that they've always gone to? I mean, are there special flowers on the Bullen Peninsula that aren't anywhere else? Or what are they feeding there? I mean, has there been any research done on the actual requirements of the bumblebees?
There has been, but I think the bigger, while there's a lack of diversity of plants, if I was to say to you that the only thing you can get is a limited amount of food and you'd only eat all your meals from McDonald's for the rest of your life or something like that, you wouldn't be thriving very well. You'd be craving other pollens and other nectars. Mm-hmm. Our diversity is gone. And we have to make national and global decisions how we tackle this. It has to be planned out. And it's not, we keep thinking in the short term of 1 year, 3 years. We have to be planning for the next 100 years.
But there is a pollinator plan, which has been going on since 2015, if I'm not mistaken.
It has been excellent. It has been excellent. It has brought awareness. Well, like, we wouldn't be talking about this 20 years ago. We're talking about it now because they've done a fantastic job of bringing it to the public awareness.
They have, but in fairness, Paul, we have been talking about it for 20 years.
With one
of your former colleagues, Philip McCabe, the late Philip.
A very close friend.
As you know, indeed, of course. Yeah. So we were always talking about it on this programme. Andy, you might just talk about that National Pollinator Plan, just to remind people what it is.
Yeah, the National Pollinator Plan. It's an all-Ireland pollinator plan, and the first phase of it is 2015 to 2020, as you have said. And what they have done is they've gone through all the different habitats. I was just at a meeting last night in Newbridge where they were handing them out again, and there's a document for farmland, there's a document for gardens, there's a document for hedgerows, there's a document for each of these things, there's documents for local communities, what they can all do. And in fact, the thing I'm holding in my hand here is pollinator friendly plants for your garden. Now, these are not necessarily native wildflowers that people call weeds. These are actually things you can buy in the shop if you want to. Lovely herbs like rosemary and borage you can plant in springtime. Things like scabious and verbena you can put in the summer. And then there's a range of them in the autumn as well, heathers and salvias. And in winter, then you have your hellebores and your viburnums and your mahonias and willow. Willow is great. So this is what the pollinator plan is encouraging people to do, because bees are the only creatures that want pollen. Pollen is collected by bees to feed their young with, and they collect nectar then to feed the grown-ups with. In the case of honeybees, they make the nectar into honey. In the case of bumblebees and solid, they just collect the nectar for them to eat as nectar. Other insects will go for the nectar, like things like butterflies and that, and the pollen is kind of a nuisance to them. It just gets stuck on their head. But the bees actually collect the pollen, so they're focused on going to plants with lots of pollen on them. That's why things like willow are full of pollen, though they don't necessarily go on to have flowers or petals on them. They've catkins with loads of pollen on them, which are very valuable for bees this time of the year, early in the year when the pollen is there.
Yeah, the decline of the insects globally is around 3.7% per annum. But in Ireland, we're 1% above that average.
Why is that?
I would say that it's because of our increase in our dairy industry. In every single field that we have tillage or grassland, we're probably using about herbicides about 15 times per annum on the same piece of field. So we're wiping them out.
50% of Ireland's land, 50% is covered in grass. Grassland for farming, 50%. Now, the other 50 isn't. And the farmers who grow grass to feed their animals really want grass. They don't want buttercups and they don't want other bloody things taking up space when it could be 100% grass. And this is what the farming work is. So the herbicides are used to get rid of non-grass flowers.
Well,
so
the farmers have to live too, you know.
Well, I'm not saying yay or nay to that. I'm just saying 50%. And Paul is right. So these fields of grass that fed animals, fed cows when I was young, me and Finn McCool, were actually hay meadows and there were flowers in them. And they weren't cut till July, so that the stuff that was on the ground, the bees, bumblebees nests, were left alone until July. Now they get a number one haircut in May for silage, and that any animals that might be living in the soil just at the bottom of those meadows are removed as well. So not only are there no flowers for them to actually feed on, but the little holes in the bottoms of the fields where the bumblebees will have their nests are being removed by that silage making. We think of silage as putting an end to the poor old corncrake, and it is, but it's also putting an end to the poor old bumblebees who nest at the bottom of the ground in the soil under the hayfields.
But we could tackle that by leaving strips of land at the edges and let them go into wild. Let
clover, we could, of course, yeah. I mean, it's not impossible. Let clover come back. Yeah. And farmers could have their cake and eat it. They could have their grass. If they didn't want to, bloody well take out every hedge for the extra strip of whatever it is that they get. If they left a border, a headland and under hedge, they'd have, you know, it wouldn't take up that much.
But I wouldn't expect the farmer to be out of pocket either. I think as a society, we should pay for that and say, fine, Mr. Farmer, Mrs. Farmer, we'll give you a grant to keep 2 metres at the edge into wildlife, and we should pay them. And
yeah, but I mean, we have the GLAS schemes, but that tends to be not the really intensive farmers. It tends to be the extensive ones, which is at least good at any rate.
A few things, Paul. We're mentioning how they don't see red. Yes, some of the bumblebees have red on their plumages. Presumably the bees see a red-tailed bumblebee in a different kind of way, and they are able to detect the redness indirectly. The other thing I wanted to bring up was the extraordinary intelligence. There was some research in Queen Mary College a few years ago showing that bumblebees are able to work and solve problems with little balls that they would push to the centre of a sphere, and the ball would then tumble in and they would get a reward. And when this was tried on bumblebees, they were extremely astute at knowing which ball was nearest to the hole and things like that, and the colours of balls, and some were better than others. These are a very adaptive and capable kind of set of animals. There should be hope for them. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. They've been here well before we came onto planet Earth, and I've a funny feeling they'll be here well after we're all gone. They are well able to adapt. And just going back to the colours, for your listeners, if they ever get a chance and look at the web, you'll find a thing called nectar glides. And as Aina was, it's like Dublin Airport, all the plants have their own nectar glides, and they're in ultraviolet spectrum. And when the bee flies along, they'll be lit up and they look like, bring them right down to where the nectar is. And another thing, that flowers talk to the insects, and you say, how do they do that in this day and age? If you take a glass at home and fill it full of water and hit it with the spoon, it's a different resonance. And when you empty out the glass, it's got a higher frequency of resonance. And the bees are listening to the flowers and they're being vibrated from the wind. And they know not to waste their time going down to an empty glass.
That's how they know the nectar's gone by the previous bee has taken it.
So you talk about the intelligence. You can see that intelligence yourself. And kids often ask me this question, when a bee lands in a bunch of marigolds, they go, why do they go for one and not the other? Because they can hear it and they can see it.
No one has nothing in it.
And it's been suggested that individual plants put out electric fields, which the bees detect. Mm. They have their own, shall we say, frequency of electrical transmission.
Well, there is, and they use polarised light.
Thing.
They use polarised light and they use electric magnetic fields. And as well as that, the American intelligence people, we'll call it that, they started using bees to track down explosives. Like you say with the bumblebee, they were training bees to get rewards, and then they were asking them to find explosives, and they were excellent at doing this.
Paul, if these were falcons or hawks, they would go to the wall more quickly than the ones below them, the little songbirds and things on which hawks and falcons feed. Now, there are these cuckoo bees. Now, if there is a big problem, surely the cuckoo bees will go out of business before the others. How are our cuckoo bees doing?
They are surviving, but no more than the ordinary bees. They're under the exact same pressure. If there's not enough nests for them to lay their offspring in, then they will disappear too. I wouldn't identify one over the other. They're all in trouble, and it's a balance.
It seems to me, though, that it's the way we treat our environment in Ireland that's the greatest culprit, rather than saying, oh, it's climate change and we can do nothing about that. I mean, if we treated our environment properly, I know climate change is happening, but it's happening at a greater rate in other parts of the world. So we really can't sit back and say, well, what can we do? It's climate change. We can do lots and lots of things managing our environment in a proper way for bees. We can't get off the hook by just saying it's climate change.
Oh, I think we've speeded up the destruction of our environment in Ireland over the last 20 years.
Well, worldwide, January was the warmest January on record for 141 years, apparently.
Imagine that. I fully agree with Aina. We're doing it faster.
Because we were
way behind. We had non-intensive agriculture in the 60s. And then I think once we joined the EU and lately, since we increased the dairy, we're full on with our intensive agriculture.
At least we got rid. We got rid of the neonicotinoids, those poisons that were actually affecting not only the plants, but also the nectar and the pollen. They used those in America to spray their almond trees. So all these people who are now drinking almond milk instead of cow's milk are actually encouraging the growth of almond trees being sprayed and the death of loads of bees that are brought over to California to pollinate those. But that's another story.
Paul, you wanted this. Paul was saying well when you said that. Go on, Paul, yeah.
Well, if you go back to the original, Annie, you were saying if we put too many beehives in an area, we kill the other insects around us. That's the same way. If we keep going with one food product, almond milk is the new hoo-ha, avocados next, there'll be something else, and, you know, coconut palm trees were being destroying other places. I don't know what's wrong with it. We seem to crave something new in our diet or something new in our shop fronts without thinking long term about the consequences. Air miles, food miles, all this stuff, we're not thinking. And I have to say, it's wonderful what Greta Thunberg has done in a sense. She's brought this awareness into the younger generations and they're thinking about it. But yet they go to the protest and they go home on their phones, which are hard to make in the environment. They drive home in their cars. And we have to just stop and start from the beginning and say, what can we do now that's going to make a change in 100 years? And it's a whole multitude of small changes, lots of little changes. Collectively, we'll get there.
Well, Paul, it's lovely to speak with you. That's Paul O'Brien. He's president of the Federation of Irish Beekeepers. And we will make sure that you can find some information about the National Biodiversity Data Centre All-Ireland Pollinator Plan 2015 to 2020 on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Be kind to the bees, Paul. Isn't that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And if you want to do something for the next 9 weeks over the last of the winter, take up a beekeeping course. You don't have to keep the bees, but take up the course and come to the lectures and you might be fascinated what all the women do in the beehive. As Anna says, it's 97% female and they work themselves to death for the poor lads.
Paul, nothing unusual there. Paul, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.